This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, the story of an explorer, naturalist, writer, and pirate, William Dampier. Born in the mid-17th century, he was the first man known to have sailed three times around the world. He wrote about subspecies in the Galapagos Islands before Charles Darwin. He deduced the relationship between wind and currents. The poet and philosopher Samuel Taylor Coleridge called him a man of exquisite mind. Our guest is writer Diana Preston. She and her husband Michael are the authors of the new book, A Pirate of Exquisite Mind, Explorer, Naturalist, and Buccaneer, The Life of William Dampier. In this portion of the program, we'll hear about the contributions of this man, including the words he introduced into the English language, words we use every day. He has over 1,000 entries in the Oxford English Dictionary. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Diana Preston is the author of three previous books, including a first-rate tragedy, Robert Falcon Scott and the Race to the South Pole, The Boxer Rebellion, and Lusitania, an epic tragedy. The book she's written with her husband, Michael, A Pirate of Exquisite Mind, is published by Walker & Company. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Diana Preston, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be with you, Celeste.
What set you and your husband on course to write this biography?
Well, we were researching generally about pirates, and we kept coming across references to this man, William Dampier, and we began to realize that this had been a very significant individual who contributed in so many areas, but we really couldn't find out enough about him. But then we also came across a reference to the fact that he had a big portrait painted, and it was hanging in the National Portrait Gallery in London. And we went to take a look at it. It's a big, compelling oil painting, and underneath is this little notice which says William Dampier, pirate and hydrographer. And we thought, well, wait a minute, if you're a pirate, how come you get your portrait painted by a well-known portrait artist of the late 17th century? Mostly the pictures of pirates you come across, if you do manage to find them, are of scenes of their execution or of their trials. And yet here was this man with a very lean, compelling face, looking straight at you and holding a book in his hand, the spine turned towards the onlooker. And we thought, this is just a story we have to find out a bit more about.
Yeah, well, his portrait is the basis for the cover of the book, the jacket. And he looks like a very sensitive pirate, I must say.
He looks sensitive. He looks very intelligent. That's what struck
us.
But there's also quite an obstinate cast to his mouth and his chin. I think he certainly wasn't an easy person to voyage with. He didn't suffer fools gladly.
Yeah.
Quite impatient. One of the buccaneers that he did sail with called him a self-conceited young man. So I think he was probably quite a tough individual in many ways.
Yeah, well, among the words used to describe him are these: intelligent, an opportunist, a man of curiosity, a patriot, a peacemaker, tolerant, a poor leader, a loner.
Yeah, I think that all of those describe him. And it just shows you the diversity of William Dampier and the complexity of him, I guess. I mean, you picked up there on his open-mindedness. I think he was born at just the right time for someone of his sort of intellectual cast of mind. This period, the mid to late 17th century, really was the threshold of the Age of Enlightenment. It was still a time of intolerance, witch burnings, all that kind of stuff, but it was also an age where people were beginning to look for more rational explanations for natural and physical phenomena, and that exactly suited William Dampier. You know, he began his life with the Buccaneers, I think fueled by a desire above all for Spanish gold. He wrote about his golden dreams. He wanted to capture a Spanish treasure galleon. But he became seduced by a quest for knowledge, driven by a really burning curiosity. And that's what really turned him from a pirate into a traveler, and later into a best-selling writer, a naturalist, a scientist, whose influence is felt even today in so many areas.
Mm. He was a celebrity in his day. He was a very accomplished man, yet he's not well-known in our day. Mm. Why is that?
That really interested us, because we thought, well, how come this man who achieved so much is just forgotten about? Certainly in England, we know very little of him. Same in the United States. The only place where he's at all well-known is in Australia, because he was with the first party of Englishmen to land on the mainland of Australia. I think what happened was that in his own lifetime, he achieved huge success when he gave up the buccaneering, returned to England, published his best-selling travel books. You know, he was taken up by everybody. He became a celebrity. He made that journey from complete obscurity to being a very well-known figure in the London literary and scientific world. He got put in charge of a formal English naval expedition to go back and take another look at Australia. All the writers of his day, you know, Daniel Defoe, later on Jonathan Swift, read his work and were influenced by it. Later on, the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge praised his exquisite mind, hence the title of the book. Mm-hmm. But by the time you get into the 19th century, you have the Victorians coming along. It's all getting very prim and proper. And the idea to them that a man who'd started life as a buccaneer, that he could have achieved anything worthwhile, was a sort of anathema. And once you get into that period, you can see his reputation being rubbished. You can really watch William Dampier sort of sailing over the horizon of history and dropping completely out of view. And yet for, you know, well over 100 years after his death, he was a very well-known individual. It was the taint of piracy, of buccaneering, if you like, that did for his reputation later on.
Hmm. You mentioned that this time, the time that he lived, was a time when intellectual curiosity was fostered. Inquiry, I think you say at one point, was fashionable. Hmm. What else should we know about the times Dampier lived in?
It was in many ways a very, in the true sense of the word, a very curious age. People were beginning to seek for explanations of things which prior to that they had just attributed to even witches and hobgoblins, or that they'd attributed to some sort of religious explanation that mustn't be questioned. It really was a time where people were starting to reach out to get a better perception of the physical world around them. I mean, to give you an idea, the time that Dampier was sailing, many people attributed the phenomenon you would sometimes see at sea of what looked like a sort of a light dancing around the top of the mast that we would today call St. Elmo's fire. You know, some mariners of that day would attribute it to witches and hobgoblins, but Dampier and others were starting to realize that this was actually some sort of scientific phenomenon. And the people like Dampier who voyaged far afield, they were really being encouraged to record and report data by some of the really big, heavy-hitting thinkers of the day. You have the Royal Society having just been set up by King Charles II. Now, this involved people like the astronomer Halley. It involved Samuel Pepys, the writer John Evelyn. And these people, highly influential in London, were saying to people like Dampier, look, bring us back data, bring us back information. And Dampier was amongst the very first people to respond to that call, and he went further, if you like. He didn't just bring back data and observations. He also interpreted them, and that's also one of the reasons why he's so important, and why he fits so well into this, as I described it earlier, this age of curiosity.
Hmm. He was born in the west of England to a tenant farmer. His parents died when he was quite young. What kind of life did he have as a boy?
As a boy, as you say, he was orphaned young, but he had brothers and sisters. In particular, he had an older brother, George, who looked after him. And he was clearly a very bright, clever boy. He caught the eye of the local squire. We found papers in the local archives showing that, you know, even as, you know, 12 or 13 years old, Dampier was writing about nature as he saw it, just in the limited confines of rural England. We know that very early on he was driven by a consuming curiosity to go further afield. You know, life in England A rural farmer's life was not world enough for him, and as soon as he was able to, he persuaded his brother and his guardians to let him sign up and join the Navy, and he went off and fought in England's wars against the Dutch. And that, I think, whetted his appetite for marine travel and for seeing the world. And when he later on returned to Somerset, he tried to settle down again, but he was just too restless. It wouldn't work. And it was then that the squire said to him, well, look, you know, I've got a sugar plantation in Jamaica. I'll give you a job there. And that was really when William Dampier packed up and went off to the Caribbean. And that's really, if you like, where his story really starts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What was his education?
We know very little about that, except what we can deduce by sort of back-fitting from later on what we know of his life. But I believe that he went to one of the local grammar schools in Somerset. And the reason I say that is that when he, later on in his life, he really had transformed into, if you like, the first backpacker, the first hippie. He was traveling overland into Vietnam, and he got very, very sick. And a French Catholic priest took him in. And we know that as he was nursing Dampier back to health, they had difficulties at first in communicating. Dampier could speak no French, the priest could speak no English, but what they could converse in was Latin. And so that showed me that Dampier had had a grounding in the classics, and that means that he had been to one of what we in England would call the grammar schools, where people were grounded in the classics, perhaps taught a little bit of science, a little bit of mathematics, as it then was at that time. So he didn't go forth into the world, you know, completely untutored, completely uneducated. He'd had the benefit of that, but it was really his natural intellect, his natural curiosity, which really took him from those early, relatively humble beginnings right into the forefront of 17th century thinking.
Yeah. He wasn't long in the Caribbean before he became a log wooder. What was that trade?
Yeah, as you say, it didn't take him long to join up with his strange fraternity. The job on the sugar plantation that he went out to Jamaica to do didn't last long. He was impatient. He said he wasn't going to be a slave. He punched the plantation manager. And he went off and he joined these logwooders. They were on the Caribbean coast of Mexico, the Bay of Campeche, and they were basically, it was an all-male society, virtually. Many of them were former buccaneers, or intended to be buccaneers again, but they had stumbled on these plantations, or these naturally occurring forests of logwood, which was a timber which was highly prized in Europe at the time. The heart of the logwood yielded a very valuable dye, which was used principally for furniture, but also for fabrics. And at home in Europe, people will pay literally thousands of dollars a ton for this wood, a phenomenal sum of money for the time. And Dampier hoped, as he did on many times in his life, that he was going to be able to make his fortune. He joined up with his male fraternity, living in mosquito-ridden swamps. They sort of worked up to their waists in swampy water, hewing the wood, dragging it down to the beach to be collected up and shipped off, also having to fight off Spanish patrols, because the Spanish regarded that part of the world as their territory. If they'd caught any of these logwooders, they would have enslaved them. That happened to many. So it was a dangerous, precarious life. But it was where Dampier's interest in natural history began to develop. But at the same time, as I was saying, he hoped to make his fortune. He had accumulated his share of logwood, but one night a terrible storm blew in. It destroyed his boat. It destroyed everything that he had managed to acquire. And that's what pushed him into the arms of the buccaneers.
Yeah. Well, he puts in with what he calls privateers, but you say they were buccaneers.
Yes, I mean, there's a lot of ambiguity about this. You know, what is a pirate? What is a buccaneer?
Right.
What is a privateer? Early in his life, in some instances, Dampier was an out-and-out pirate, by which I mean someone who really was just a robber on the high seas. He did draw the line at attacking ships of his own nation, but he sometimes was involved in attacks on neutral shipping. Certainly in the annals of Spain and many other countries, you will find William Dampier referred to as a pirate. The buccaneers were a very specific group of marauders operating in the Caribbean, and they lived sometimes a legal existence. It all depended on the politics back home in England. England during this period was more often than not at war with Spain, and in those circumstances, having only a very small navy, it was very useful for the English government to employ the buccaneers to try and keep the Spanish at bay and to protect English possessions in the Caribbean. So part of Dampier's voyaging with the buccaneers was, if you like, semi-official, or at least the government back home were prepared to turn a blind eye to it. But later in his career, he became, and this is a word, as you say, he's very fond of using, a privateer. But a privateer is something very different to a buccaneer or a pirate. That's when your own government says, well, look, you know, our country is at war. We would like your help in going out and attacking our enemies. So here's a piece of paper, if you like, giving you carte blanche. It's like a license to go and attack. Go and attack this nation's enemies. Seize the cargoes of our enemies' shipping. But, by the way, we'd like 10% of the profits, please. That's what a privateer was. And Dampier, as you say, he's always very careful in his published writings to describe himself as a privateer. He was very concerned to present himself as respectable. But if you read his unpublished manuscripts, it is an out-and-out, unadorned account of buccaneering, sometimes of true piracy, that fits very well with, you know, Dampier as a sort of Jack Sparrow character, if you've seen Pirates of the Caribbean. Mm. That's very much what Dampier was in his early days, and that comes through his own raw writings before he tidied them up for publication for The Polite World.
Yeah, Jack Sparrow and the Doctor from the Patrick O'Brien
Absolutely.
Stories.
I mean, that struck us completely, that Dampier, during his lifetime, makes this transition from this rumbustious, you know, rum-swigging pirate, just like Jack Sparrow, and he turns himself into Stephen Maturin in Master and Commander, the fighting naturalist. He's still a very tough individual. He can fight his way out of trouble. He's not afraid of a sword fight. But what he really likes to do is to sit down quietly with his notebook and record nature. And I found that just such an extraordinary transition.
Yeah, and he was very careful to preserve these writings. You describe him getting hold of a bamboo and wrapping, you know, rolling them up, putting them into the bamboo, and then using wax to seal both ends.
Yeah, I mean, I found that incredibly impressive because, you know, when he was still with the buccaneers, he marched over the Isthmus of Panama with them to try and attack Panama City, and that's when he really started to take notes. And as part of our research, we went in his footsteps. You know, we went through the Panamanian jungle, and we found it difficult enough to keep notes. It was exhausting business. Our notebooks were covered with, you know, blood and mosquito repellent and goodness knows what else. And it really brought home to us William Dampier's dedication that, as you say, while he was, you know, fighting off Spanish patrols and swimming flooded rivers, he was still finding time to cut a quill pen, to mix ink, to scratch his impressions of what he was seeing on a piece of parchment, and then to roll that parchment up, conceal it inside a piece of bamboo, stopper it with wax, to preserve that through all these fights, you know, shipwrecks, voyages, all kinds of disaster and mayhem, and, you know, to get those parchments home again to England. An astonishing achievement.
Yeah. Did he intend from the outset to see these things published?
I doubt that he did. I think he probably started to record out of curiosity. He was a very curious man. He was away traveling for so many years. I'm sure that it gave him huge satisfaction to start to write down what he was seeing and to frame theories. But it was really when he came back to London that I think he got into London coffee house societies. You know, the coffee houses were just getting going. And this is where the thinkers of the day were beginning to gather to exchange and trade ideas. And I think it's here that he began to meet people like Halley, some of the leading scientists and thinkers of the day, and to learn of the sorts of things which people like the members of the Royal Society were asking for. And if you compare his unpublished raw manuscript to the published work, you can see that many of the passages travel through, translate through, but it has been shaped, it's been made more elegant, there's more science in there. It all comes from Dampier. I don't believe he was helped or anybody else gave him the material. Only he could have known those things. But I think somebody encouraged him to take this unique material that he'd come back with, you know, accounts of a world that people could not imagine. This was a time when most people in England didn't travel out of their own villages. Mm. But, you know, people persuaded him to shape that and prepare it for publication. And I think it suited him completely. And his later books, which were also published a huge success home in England and translated into many languages throughout Europe, I'm sure those later works were written precisely with publication in mind.
Mm. Very interesting. What were his political and religious views?
Mm. I wonder that, because Dampier talks very little about God in his accounts until he gets himself into really, I was going to say hot water, that's the wrong words to use. There's one particular open boat journey he makes when it really looks as if the little rowing boat that he's in is trying to escape from the buccaneers and make a landing. He wants to sort of deviate and go off on his own. So he's seized the ship and gone off, but he gets into this terrific storm. The waves are powering over the boat. It looks like they're going to be swamped. He and his friends are going to be drowned. And he starts to talk about God. It's very redolent of some of the reflections you'll find later on in Daniel Defoe and Robinson Crusoe, because Defoe read Dampier very closely. But Dampier starts to reflect about his past life and his sins, and he wants God to pardon him. That's one of the very few times he talks directly about God. And in terms of his attitude towards other people's religions, he's very interested and for a man of his age, very tolerant, very open. He records the temples that he sees, the religious rituals, in great detail and with interest, admiration. And in terms of politics, he really was a great free thinker. He was a true democrat in an age when democracy, you know, the seats, certainly back home in Europe, were still very, you know, seats were very small, not really sprouted. But he believed that it was man's right to be free. He disparaged oppressive governments, like, for instance, the Spanish government for oppressing the Indians of Central and South America. He wrote with great insight and sympathy for the plight of some of the Indians that he met. And that's repeated of all the peoples that he recorded around the world. He thought it was man's right to be free. But over and above everything else, he was determined that he, William Dampier, was going to remain a free man.
Mm. At one point, you have him in the Caribbean, and he is with his buccaneer buddies and some Mosquito Indians, and he talks about how wonderful these native peoples are, and that they were coveted by all privateers because for their expertise and for what they could do.
Very much so. I mean, these Mosquito Indians really represented everything that Dampier most admired. They were very skillful hunters. They were very tough, very determined, skillful individuals, used to living off the land, really beholden to nobody. And they sailed, they traveled with the buccaneers of their own free will. They went with them across the Isthmus of Panama into the Pacific. They were with Dampier for a long time. And it's also interesting to see how Dampier's accounts of particularly William the Mosquito Indian, a man who was marooned on an island in the Pacific, managed to survive and was rescued on another voyage, how, you know, Dampier's account of all of that fed through to the literature of the day. And in William the Mosquito Indian, we really see the seeds of Man Friday, you know, of a remarkable man able to survive in the worst of conditions, with all kinds of skills which a man, either like Robinson Crusoe or a William Dampier, would have highly coveted and admired.
Yeah. It sounds like everyone was reading his books.
They were. It seems strange to us now when William Dampier has been so forgotten. But to see the literary influences, you know, I've talked about Defoe, but if you read Jonathan Swift, if you open up Gulliver's Travels, you will find in the opening passages that Lemuel Gulliver refers to my cousin Dampier. And, you know, the later writer, Walter Scott, he believed that the personality of Lemuel Gulliver was very closely modeled on that of William Dampier himself. But it was the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge who later praised Dampier's exquisite mind and urged people to read him. Alexander von Humboldt said that Dampier was the best of all travel writers. And if you look in the scientific field as well to see who was later reading Dampier, well, you find all the great navigators, Nelson and Cook, reading him. But you also find, I thought this was remarkable, Charles Darwin read Dampier avidly. And in the red notebooks in which Darwin first framed his theories of evolution and of natural selection, you find frequent references there to Dampier. In fact, you know, Charles Darwin was so familiar with William Dampier that he referred to him as Old Dampier. He had his books with him on the Beagle. He referred to him. Dampier really provided the building blocks for his theories. I mean, just to give an example of that, William Dampier was the first person to use the word to develop the concept of subspecies. because he travelled so widely, because he'd gone all around the world, he travelled all across the oceans, he was able to make comparisons in the wildlife from the Pacific to the Atlantic to wherever else you like to think of. And so he was able to start to make deductions about relationships within species and between species. And this is what Charles Darwin picked up on. Yeah. So Dampier's influence was huge, from literature to science.
Yeah. And at Dampier's time, this willingness to consider geographic variation, this idea of subspecies, was truly remarkable, wasn't it?
It was, and in a certain sense, it was also heretical, because this was a period where, you know, many people were still being taught that, you know, the creation of the world happened at a certain time, a certain date, thousands of years earlier. Everything defined, you know, the time of day in which the world was created. And they were taught to believe that since then, nothing had changed, nothing had altered, nothing had evolved. So he was really challenging some very basic ground rules of the day. It was, in the eyes of many people, if you like, a form of heresy.
Hmm. Diana Preston is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with her this afternoon about the pirate, the explorer, the naturalist, and the writer, William Dampier. He was born in the mid-17th century, about 1651, died in 1715. He was an amazing character. Diana Preston and her husband, Michael, are the authors of the new book, A Pirate of Exquisite Mind, Explorer, Naturalist, and Buccaneer, The Life of William Dampier. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. I invite you to give us a call, join the conversation. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, let's talk about navigation and his contributions there. You note that in his day, when he was just beginning to go to sea, navigation was an art, such an art, you report, that the ship's navigator was often known as the ship's artist. What was the state of the art of navigation at that time?
Yes, you're absolutely right. It was very much regarded as an art, and, you know, navigators were so important that very often, you know, buccaneers were very unwilling to let their navigators leave them. And in Dampier's time, of course, he was operating before the work of Harrison, before the solving of the longitude question. So in Dampier's day, what they had to do was to set off and sail along the latitude, and hoping, you know, by close attention to charts, by relying on other sailors' accounts or their own recollections of having made those journeys, to try and work out how many days it would take them. For instance, you know, Dampier at one stage managed to navigate a shipload of buccaneers from the coast of California to Guam. And he was going on the accounts of people as far back in his time as Sir Francis Drake, who'd made that journey. And he calculated the number of days that it was likely to take them and the latitude that they should sail along. And just to give you an idea, I mean, this was such a dangerous, complex activity. If he had overshot Guam, they knew that they were going to die of thirst and hunger. They couldn't carry enough supplies to last them. But Dampier, on that occasion, managed accurately to navigate them from California to Guam. And he later discovered that if the voyage had gone on for a couple more days, some of the crew members had been planning to kill and eat him and the captain. So it shows how important it was in those days to get your navigation right. But of course, they did not have in those days, you know, the complex instruments which would come later in the 18th century.
What kind of observations did he make about things meteorological?
He really observed all kinds of things. He studied, because of, you know, traveling 200,000 sea miles in his lifetime, he had a lot of time to study the movements of the winds and the waves, the passage of the currents. He was, as you were saying earlier, the first person really to make the connection between winds and currents. Winds were what caused the currents. And he made very acute observations of how tides worked, of the directions in which they flowed, whether it was close to the shore or far out to sea. He was very interested in wind patterns. He was the person who really produced the first integrated wind patterns of the world. He was the only person who documented how the winds and waves worked in the Pacific. And so if you look at the globes and maps that began to be produced through the 18th century, you'll find that they're all modelled on Dampier's work, because he was the only person who had travelled widely enough to be able to make those sorts of meteorological and hydrographical observations. So, I mean, hugely valuable to sailors and voyagers of his day, and also to those who came later.
Hmm. He had to be a very quick study. You know, very, very bright, very, very bright.
I think he was a very quick, intelligent man. And you can see that in his attitude to others, because when later in his career, you know, he was put in charge of a naval expedition, he was turned really from an observer, someone on the sidelines, an advisor, if you like, into a leader. And that didn't really sit very easily with him, because he just wasn't patient enough of other people's foibles, other people who weren't as intelligent as him. And, you know, on one occasion, it actually led to disaster. He was put in charge of the first English naval expedition to go back to Australia and to take a proper look at it. And he fell out with his first lieutenant, who was convinced that, you know, Dampier was basically still a pirate at heart and was going to seize the king's ship. And so Dampier had a fight with him. He put his first lieutenant ashore in Brazil. And when he eventually got back to England, he was court-martialed. And we came across the court-martial records. It's surprisingly modern language, all recorded in a very clerkly hand. But you can see a lot of the trouble was, you know, Dampier's sheer impatience with the mule-headedness and the stubbornness and stupidity of his first lieutenant. And you find this interchange between them of the first lieutenant calling Dampier an old pirating dog, and Dampier calling his first lieutenant a stupid idiot and saying, well, you know, he could kiss his ass for all he cared. It's surprisingly modern language for the 17th century and all recorded there. He wouldn't tolerate fools gladly.
Yeah. It sounds like the research, much of the research anyway, was a joy to do. I'm not quite sure I'm ready for a trek across the high seas or through the jungle of Panama, but it sounds like the research was really a joyful experience.
Most of the time, it was a joy to do, because really trying to retrace his footsteps gave us a real sense of the man, whether it was, you know, trying to go through the jungles of Panama where, you know, he was dodging Spanish patrols at the time, but we had to dodge Colombian guerrillas. We were there at an unfortunate time with guerrillas coming over the border, and so we had to be very careful where we went and what we did, and some of that was really quite tricky to handle. But also, you know, going to places like the remote parts of Western Australia, where he landed first with the Buccaneers and later with a naval expedition, and sitting on the beaches there, talking to members of the Aboriginal communities there about what this first encounter between, you know, people from Europe and the native peoples of Australia, what form that had taken and what it had meant to them, hugely moving for us, you know, hugely meaningful. I don't think we could have understood him nearly so well if we hadn't done some of that travelling. But having said that, of course, if you're studying someone who's been around the world three times, it is a glorious excuse to indulge your own curiosity for travel. So I must say we were very fortunate to have a subject who had gone so far afield.
Yeah. How do the folks in Australia think of him today? He is remembered there.
He's very well known in Australia, particularly if you go to the west coast, north of the city of Perth. You'll find a town called Dampier, you'll find headlands and bays and reefs named after Dampier, and it's all because he's so significant in their early history. He was the first Englishman to land on the mainland. He was the first person to bring back botanical specimens from that part of the world. You know, when he was sent back to take another look at Australia with this naval expedition, he brought back the first plant specimens from Australia. And he even managed to save them from shipwreck. You know, on the way back, he lost his ship off Ascension Island, but he still managed to rescue his flowers and specimens and all his botanical work and get that back to England. And it's preserved today in Oxford University. If you go to the herbarium there, someone can pull open a drawer and flip open a folder, and there you'll see the flowers that William Dampier pressed from Australia. And I just, again, find that an incredible concept, the idea of a flower-pressing pirate. You know, that he had this dedication, the interest to do this, and in spite of everything, all his travails, to get this home to England. And, of course, this has been very important in documenting the early history of Australia and its natural life. So, yes, go to Australia, and people will recognize him.
Yeah. Now, the work he did writing about indigenous peoples, native peoples, Is that valued today by anthropologists?
It's very valued today because he was traveling at a time when, particularly in Central South American area and the Caribbean area, some of the native peoples there were already in decline, disappearing. He wrote one of the very few accounts that's been left of the Carib Indians, for example. So he was describing the lives of people who were already, if you like, passing into memory, suffered so much from the arrival, the depredations of Europeans on their islands, suffering their diseases, their greed. All these things, you know, Dampier documented, but he commented on how these people were living, how some of them were still managing to survive. He had a natural sympathy with them, how they were, some of them were trying to keep their independence, some of them were moving from island to island, trying to avoid falling into the hands of the, you know, newly arriving expanding colonial powers in the area. So still immensely valuable to people even today, even though we're talking about a passage of 300 years.
We've mentioned a couple of times Jack Sparrow and Stephen Maturin, which I want to kind of come around to that drama, the drama of those figures. And I want to ask you, so what was the life of a buccaneer like?
Oh, the life of a buccaneer was rough, tough stuff. It was very, very precarious, and this comes very much through Dampier's writing. If you read his journals, you understand exactly what that life was like. The danger of the fighting, the descriptions of the terrible injuries during battles, you know, not just sword wounds, but what it was like if you were caught in crossfire from cannon or blunderbusses. The fights that happened amongst the buccaneers themselves, although they had a democratic code, they did, if you like, have an early form of democracy. They often fell out. They often fought amongst each other. They argued over the division of spoils. They frequently divided. There was disease as well. You know, scurvy, which people didn't thoroughly understand at that time. There was bad food, rotting water. You can imagine what it was like on one of those long voyages, you know, sailing out into unknown, uncharted waters, hoping to clap eyes on a rich prize on the horizon, but maybe not seeing anything for days, drifting along with your food starting to be eaten by worms, starting to crawl with flies, your water rotting, the uncertainty of whether in a week's time you would still be alive. You know, I've often asked myself, why did people do it? You know, I think, you know, part of the answer is the hope of enriching themselves, particularly in that era, the hope of getting their hands on Spanish gold, on Spanish treasure. But at least, I think in spite of the hardships and the privations and the dangers, it wasn't boring. And I think that's what got to Dampier. And you could see that in his accounts, every time the buccaneers had a fight about where they were going to go, what they were going to do next, every time Dampier opted to sail to a part of the world that he hadn't seen next. So it was, in spite of the hard, tough, dangerous life, it was curiosity, I think, and the ability to satisfy that, which provided a compensation for Dampier. But I'm amazed he lived as long as he did. You know, he died at home, in bed, in London, in 1715 at the age of 65, despite having, you know, fought his way around the world, caught all manner of diseases. He must have had a very good constitution. I don't know about, you know, Atkins diets and everything today, but I'd love to know what his secrets were for longevity.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like the diet wasn't key to his survival, although at this point you mentioned scurvy. They were beginning to understand that that what they would call salad was critical.
They did have an understanding of that. You're absolutely right. And you find that on some of the islands which they frequented, where they used to go and hide out from the Spaniards, they would actually plant what they call salading vegetables. So they would know that if they called in there in a few months' time, they should find some greenery to eat. So they knew that if they got sick, eating fresh food, particularly green things, which they quickly developed a craving for, that would make them better. But in this era, no one was yet making the connection that if you kept eating those things in the first place, you wouldn't get ill.
Yeah.
So that wasn't yet known.
Yeah. How dangerous were these folks?
The buccaneers?
Yeah.
Very dangerous in certain circumstances. There were, I mean, a number of instances of acute you know, inhumanities. I mean, Dampier documents some of these very well. I mean, one of the problems was that the buccaneers themselves felt vulnerable, particularly when they were they'd crossed over the isthmus into the Pacific. They knew that the Spanish knew they were there, that they were effectively, at the same time as they were hunting Spanish ships, they were, in a sense, the target, the prey themselves. Everything depended on good intelligence, of knowing where the treasure fleets were sailing, which towns were expecting a shipment of gold or silver and would be worth raiding. So what they would often do was, if they came across a ship with completely innocent local people sailing, you know, from one place to the next, up along the South American coast, they would seize that ship or that boat, and they would torture those people for information. They'd sometimes be completely ruthless, and sometimes when they believed that people had not told them everything they knew, they would kill them and throw them overboard. Dampier, particularly in his unpublished manuscript, touches on some of those sorts of instances. So, you know, the buccaneers could be very ruthless and dangerous people. They could also be, in spite of their code of conduct amongst themselves, they could be very disloyal to each other. If there was a, you know, mighty pile of gold that they'd managed to capture, that could be fighting over how that should be divided in reality, whatever they'd agreed in the first place. Mm-hmm. Certainly I would not, you know, imagine what it would be like to fall into their hands. I think it would have been a very unpleasant, frightening experience. Many of them were ruffians, rogues, prepared to stop at nothing.
And if you were one of them, if you faltered and fell, you could be done for. They would kill you. As you mentioned, intelligence was so important. They wouldn't want you to fall into the hands of someone who was after them.
That's right. I mean, especially when Dampier, with the buccaneers, after a very unsuccessful time of bloodthirsty but unproductive marauding in the Pacific, Dampier and a small group decided to get back over the Isthmus of Panama to the Caribbean, where they felt safer. They made a pact that if anybody fell ill or became wounded, that they couldn't leave them behind, because the Spaniards, in their turn, would torture them to find out how many buccaneers there were and where they were going, that they would have to kill them. But it's interesting to find that although people did get injured and did get sick, they couldn't actually bring themselves to do that. By that stage, they'd traveled together too much. They had become a band of brothers, if you like. And so they actually did their best to help themselves along, and they didn't fulfill that threat.
He wrote about so much. One of the things, though, he didn't write much of anything, or if anything, was his marriage, his wife, Judith.
Yes, I'd love to know more about Judith. All we know about this was that during a brief return to England, he married a woman whose name is Judith out of a nobleman's household in London. We don't know if she was a relation of that nobleman or if she was a servant there. But we do know that he said to her, "I'm just going back to Jamaica for a few months, my dear, for a little bit of trading." And he did not come home for 12 years. Now, remarkably enough, I mean, she had neither died during that period, nor had she married anybody else. They were, according to papers we found, reunited, because we find them setting up house together. And we know that when Dampier went away sailing again, he made financial provision for her. But we also know that I think she was about the only person in his life that Dampier was actually quite nervous of, because I came across one letter where he was investing in a future voyage, and he says to his friend, "Look, I have invested all the money that I have, all my possessions, everything I own in this voyage." And he says, I am afraid to tell my wife Judith. Would you please tell her, but wait until I have been at sea for a couple of days." So she was clearly a formidable lady. But they clearly stayed together, you know, for many years, probably till Judith died. We know that she predeceased him. We found his will, which makes no mention of her. But I don't believe that they had any children in England, but we have recently come across evidence that, as well as his wife Judith in England, he may have contracted a bigamous marriage while he was in Virginia. There's some evidence now of a branch of the Dampier family there. There's evidence that he contracted a common law marriage to a woman called Eleanor. And so we're following that up now. But we find it a very intriguing thought that there are American Dampiers, perhaps.
He was a man always moving until his career was at an end. Did he have a favorite place?
Oh, he loved Southeast Asia. I mean, even as a very young man, he said that, having, I think, been once up to Newfoundland, that he hated cold climates, so his preference was always to voyage in warmer seas. And the place that he really loved, I think, was Southeast Asia. He writes lyrically about the Philippines, about Vietnam, where he really, you know, he traveled inland as a sort of backpacker, hippie character, as I was saying before, and he observed the customs. He was fascinated by what people ate. He wrote detailed accounts of how soy sauce was produced and Thai fish sauce. He often wrote about food. It shows the preoccupations of a 17th century pirate. And many of the words that he put into the English language, I think, come from his travels in that part of the world. I mean, he even gave us the words chopsticks. He got as far as China
right.
and the Chinese coast. So he liked to travel to those parts of the world, to places that he found exotic.
Yeah. We really didn't talk about that, all the words that came into the English language, thanks
yeah,
to
we
him.
Were absolutely staggered to find, you know, we just looked in the Oxford English Dictionary, almost by chance, and found that Dampier has got over 1,000 entries. And if you look, say, just go from the top of the alphabet, and you'll find that he gave us avocado, he gave us barbecue, gave us cashew nut, breadfruit, kumquat. You know, you can go on through the alphabet, so many words, so many phrases. Just an astonishing influence on language. And I think it's a tribute, again, to the detail of his observations and the vividness of his descriptions, that when he wrote all this down and published it, people were so fascinated by it. He really pushed back their horizons, even though these were people who were never going to travel anywhere. He enabled them to make a mental journey. He enriched their life, and he used such wonderful language to do it with. He used homely language, similes that people could understand. He could tell people what a hummingbird was like, something as exotic as that to English eyes, by describing it as being like a big overgrown wasp or bumblebee. He could describe a poison blow dart, of which, you know, he had plenty of experience, but as being like a knitting needle. He had a way of capturing people's imaginations, of making the exotic real, bringing that into their home. And, you know, his use of language, his ability to describe, his enrichment by increasing our vocabulary, was really quite phenomenal.
Mm. Well, Diana, thank you for bringing him to our armchairs. I want to thank you very much for that and for visiting with us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you so much, Celeste. It really has been my pleasure.
Diana Preston, she and her husband Michael are the authors of A Pirate of Exquisite Mind, Explorer, Naturalist, and Buccaneer, The Life of William Dampier. The book is published by Walker & Company.